Case number 23-5149. J. Gregory Sidek versus United States International Trade Commission et al. Appellants. Mr. Saltzman for the appellants, Mr. Landau for the appellee.
Whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court, Joshua Saltzman on behalf of the International Trade Commission. The district court here committed a series of errors in entering an injunction that will prevent the commission from even determining whether plaintiff Gregory Sidek improperly retained the confidential business information of private companies like Apple and Intel in violation of a voluntarily assumed obligation.
Mr. Saltzman, if I can ask you a question at the threshold, is it the ITC's position that this investigation is based solely on the protective order?
So I think the enforcement here is predicated on the protective order, but the protective order goes hand in hand and is only applicable to Mr. Sidek because of his separate agreement signed 3 months later in November of 2017 when he signed that acknowledgement that you can find at JA 48.
The investigation with respect to whether sanctions should be imposed is based on the protective order, solely on the protective order.
I agree that under the commission regulations that are that form the basis for the investigation here, what he is being investigated for, and I do want to emphasize that we are still just at the preliminary phases of that investigation, is a possible breach of the protective order. But I don't think you can analyze the protective order in a vacuum without recognizing that the reason we are here is because when that protective order issued in August of 2017, it had no adverse impact on Mr. Sidek. But
I know the merits.
Sorry. Follow up to that, which is, so I just want to be just clear that the ITC is not relying on, you know, the fact that Mr. Sidek may have violated some separate statutory or regulatory requirement, that the investigation is based solely on the violation of the protective order.
That is how the letter from the commission secretary is framed.
You are not claiming any broader investigative authority.
Yes,
turns out to be actually quite important. So
I'm happy to engage on that and try to explain to you why I think under the facts here. But
the merits aren't directly before us, but what is the government's colorable argument for being able to have a proceeding whose sole purpose is to enforce an order entered by an unconstitutionally appointed ALJ?
You know, I think it sounds shocking when you say the order is unconstitutional. It has a lot of shock value, but it's actually much less remarkable than you might think. So even the district court here, for example, seem to assume that this order could still be enforced against Apple and Qualcomm. And for example, in the Ryder case, the Supreme Court held that military judges were unconstitutionally appointed. It provided a remedy to the plaintiff there. It said there were probably going to be 7 to 10 additional cases that would be affected by its ruling. But the court suggested that habeas claims by people whose cases had otherwise become final would almost surely fail. And the reason is because for non-jurisdictional defects, like an appointments clause defect, finality has always been understood to continue to severely restrict the scope of available relief. And with good reason, the Supreme Court has recognized for hundreds of years that it would be horribly disruptive if a defect in title could somehow unsettle long-settled expectations. And I think that's particularly true here with the reliance interests.
Then I guess comes back to the argument you did make about untimeliness. And, you know, he should have teed this up. We've got two different proceedings, right? One is Qualcomm versus Apple,
yep,
before an unconstitutionally appointed ALJ. The other one is ITC versus, is it Sidek, for some sort of enforcement action before a lawfully constituted ITC.
That's right, Your Honor. But first of all, on the merits,
it's a very odd.
I, th-
It's very odd to imagine, if that's the right way of thinking about it, you know, the witness, the expert witness sort of has an obligation to raise the appointments clause issue in the first proceeding.
So there, I want to distinguish between two different merits arguments we've made, since we seem to have, and I'm fine with this, we seem to have skipped over the ripeness argument.
We'll
come back to that, I know. But I want to distinguish between two arguments because they have different implications. One is sort of a forfeiture, you might think of it as a consent argument. In November, when he signed that agreement, in November of 2017, when he signed it, he agreed, in his own words, he'd read the protective order and agreed to abide by his terms. At that point, he voluntarily relinquished any challenge to having to abide by the restrictions. And remember, he was doing that because he wanted a benefit. He wanted access to confidential information that he was otherwise statutorily barred from receiving. He wanted to be able to earn a fee as an expert witness for Qualcomm. And in order to get the documents necessary to perform that function, he had to agree to abide by reasonable safeguards to ensure that they were only used for proper purposes. So that's argument one. I
have a question about that, which is where does the authority come then to bind Mr. Sidek? Is it from his consent or is it from the protective order that was issued by the ALJ?
I would say it comes from his consent. It comes from, well, the protective order. So at the time that the protective order was issued in August of 2017, it did not bar Mr. Sidek from anything. There was a statute. There was a statutory backdrop.
In general terms, it applies to anybody who participates in the proceeding. And then the order itself requires people who participate to sign a letter of acknowledgement. But the order by its terms, even, you know, without a letter of acknowledgement, would apply to an expert like Mr. Sidek.
It
seems to me.
Well, you start from a statutory backdrop, right? I think it's important to understand that the protective orders are rising against the backdrop of Section 1337N. That's a categorical prohibition on sharing confidential information disclosed to the commission, except as authorized by the protective order. So the protective order is in some case, in you could characterize it as the permission slip. You would be barred, that Qualcomm would have been barred from sharing Apple and Intel's information with Mr. Sidek, but for the protective order. And the protective order provides a mechanism that allows for sharing, but also, as one would reasonably expect, imposes reasonable conditions, says only use it for purposes of this investigation, keep the material safe, destroy or return it at the termination of the proceeding. And anybody who wants the benefit of being able to take advantage of that authorization, that exception to the statute, the mechanism for sharing information, has to agree to abide by reasonable terms. And that's what Mr. Sidek.
That's right. You should be going after Qualcomm, not Sidek.
Well, I don't think that's right under the circumstances here, because Mr. Sidek made representations. Everybody reasonably relied on the representations that he would abide by the conditions that went hand in hand with his receipt of that information.
But as a legal matter, the conditions are void. There never were any conditions. It was as if something called a protective order was issued by four or five random people in the phone book, and they called it an ITC protective order. I think, right?
I actually don't agree with that, Your Honor. And the reason I would say that is because appointments clause defects are non-jurisdictional. They certainly can be a basis when timely raised for setting aside governmental action. But it is not that as if they never occurred, or that an order taken by an improperly appointed official can never be given legal effect, even years later and when first challenged through a collateral action. I think Mr. Sidek here had the opportunity to raise the issue to the committee.
No, go ahead.
You're
trying to separate the consent and voluntariness aspect of your merits argument from the consent aspect from the timeliness aspect.
I think those are two separate arguments.
Okay, so on the voluntariness point, I mean, if a private party goes to work for the government, you know, wants to earn a living like this guy, and is forced to sign a non-disclosure agreement, you know, to get access to classified information or government information or whatever, right? That person is not thereby barred from bringing a First Amendment challenge to argue that the non-disclosure is overbroad or whatever, right? So consent can't bar the constitutional challenge to the governmentally imposed non-disclosure requirement.
Well, I think that's a, I don't want to speak in such categorical terms because, for example, in CFTC versus Shore, and then the Federal Circuit has a couple of cases involving their inter partes review scheme that we've cited, the Siena Corp and the Valve case. When you seek out a particular judicial forum, sometimes that can go hand in hand with relinquishing a constitutional challenge, and that's to defeat sandbagging.
I'll refine it just a little bit. Doesn't automatic the fact of the voluntary aspect of this is not always a showstopper.
I'm not going to say it's always dispositive, but I'm saying in analogous circumstances.
Seems a little different. The litigant who goes to the ITC seems a little different from the expert who's, and this is what he does. He supports clients wherever they are.
Fair enough. He voluntarily chose this engagement. He voluntarily chose to put his name on a document where he assured the commission, ensured Apple and Intel that he would abide by some reasonable restrictions to safeguard that information.
Could Qualcomm have gone to an Article III or other tribunal, or does this sort of proceeding only go to the ITC?
The specific remedy that Qualcomm was seeking, this was patent infringement litigation. That's obviously certainly the kind of issue that can be brought in district court. The ITC offers a particular remedy, which is an exclusion order. Essentially, all of the iPhones would have been stopped at the border.
So it seems a little aggressive to say, oh, they made a choice to go to the forum with the questionably appointed judge, so tough luck.
So again,
that's the forum that Congress has made available for this kind of.
And I think that's Qualcomm. I think we can separately think about Mr. Sydak here, who chose to take an engagement and chose to accept access to certain documents on certain reasonable conditions. And once Apple and Intel have relied on those representations and relied on the fact that the commission will be there to enforce the security as Congress intended through 1337N.
Let me ask you about one of ITC's other regulations, though, about sanctioning non-signatories to protective orders, right? So that regulation provides that ordinarily, if someone is not a signatory, they can't be held to violate a protective order. However, if there's good cause shown, even a non-signatory can be sanctioned for violating a protective order. So doesn't that suggest that the protective orders have some authority or some legal force absent the consent of a person who's a signatory to the protective order? I mean, because you can apparently, the ITC can sanction someone who's a non-signatory.
Yeah, and that may well be. We've relied here on his status as a signatory, which I think makes this at least a much easier case, but
the government's litigating position, but it doesn't tell us where the authority comes from, right? Because if the protective order is the thing that is doing the work, and that was issued by an unconstitutional ALJ, that's a problem. If the consent is what's doing the work, then maybe, of course, it might be less of a problem.
Yeah. So,
but it seems like on the ITC's own terms, they're recognizing that the protective orders have legal authority separate from consent.
So if you're asking where the statutory authority to issue these are and to enforce them, I'd refer the court to 19 U.S.C. 1335, which is a broad delegation of rulemaking authority, and then 1337N, which I've referenced several times, and specifically contemplates that the commission will establish regulations and procedures for promulgating protective orders, because otherwise that's the only mechanism through which you have an exception to 1337N's otherwise categorical bar on the disclosure of the information.
I'm not suggesting they didn't have authority to issue the protective order. I mean, in a statutory sense, but But if the protective order is what is binding on Mr. Sidak, and that order was issued without constitutional authority, then that's a problem.
Well, it's only a problem, assuming you get past consent, it's only a problem if you think he has raised a timely challenge. Because, of course, Lucia, Ryder, they have always taken pains to emphasize that they granted relief to parties who raised timely challenges. Ryder specifically, as I mentioned earlier, distinguished any kind of collateral attack through habeas. And here, there is a value in repose. That's the principle that Ryder and Lucia carry forward from the de facto officer doctrine. This idea that it would be incredibly disruptive, that chaos would result if every act taken by an unconstitutionally appointed officer was subject to challenge collaterally years after the proceeding had gone viral.
And the defendant who's convicted in an unconstitutional proceeding has direct review, Article III review, and once the Supreme Court denies cert, that's over. It's over, and habeas is different, right? Tough luck. That's different from here.
So
Sidak as prospective administrative defendant facing exposure, that happens when they notice the enforcement proceeding.
So Sidak, I think his brief definitely tries to harp on exactly that theme, but I think it's belied by the content of the protective order. From the moment he signed it, he was under certain obligations to safeguard information, to limit his use of it in certain ways, to report leaks. And then I think the clearest example is in April of 2019, when the 1065 investigation terminated, he was under an affirmative obligation enforceable by the commission to return or destroy all of the confidential information that he had received through the proceeding. His rights were directly at issue. He had obligations at that time.
And how exactly would you have had him raise this in the original proceeding?
Okay.
Or run into district court or file, get separate counsel, motion of witness to
have ALJ
declared unconstitutionally appointed?
So there are various stages at which he could have done it. And I'm not going to tell you whether these would have worked.
Give me the most plausible one, because any of them strike me as odd.
Okay. Well, I've got three, and you maybe. So first, when this document is first put in front of him, he had an option not to sign. He had an option to sign, but say, I don't see. No, but flag, if you are going to represent to a governmental body and to private parties who are depending on that governmental body to protect their information, that you intend to abide by a series of conditions, that you have doubts about its enforceability, you should do that in a contemporaneous way. And I do want to emphasize, it's not like Lucia was an unknown issue. This had already, I think, been by this court in November of 2017. In fact, I think we filed our cert petition in November of 2017, it was a brief in opposition nominally. And then it was decided by June of 2018. So this issue was very much out in the world. The Supreme Court was granting cert at around this very same time. But then do I think the very sophisticated counsel who are representing Qualcomm and Apple in this proceeding were aware of Lucia? Absolutely. But so he was a paid expert for Qualcomm. He was certainly on the same team, to put it nominally, as Qualcomm's lawyers in the case. But
those lawyers know they're doing well to the suit. Not from
your name. No, they certainly owed it to the company, not to him. But as far as I know, he wasn't separately represented. I'm not saying that. What I am saying is that if you are going to sign a document agreeing to abide by certain conditions, particularly as part of a quid pro quo, you're getting the benefit of the access that it provides. I don't think it's fair to complain about it afterwards, but
that's what we're missing. It's a good thing that we have expert witnesses.
Absolutely.
And we would have less of them if they didn't get paid.
I have no issue with any of that. I just think that if you sign a document saying, I'm going to keep your secrets safe, that you should probably keep those secrets safe, and that if you consent to enforcement of that.
No, you don't think that every expert witness should hire an attorney, right?
No, I don't. But I do think that when you sign a document, you should make certain that you intend to, that you're serious about abiding by it, and that if you have doubts about its enforceability, you should give notice. But I did say I had three answers to Judge Katsas. If I'm happy to answer follow up, but I didn't want to forget that.
Obvious to the phrase that when you signed
right
the order, what, signed it
with reservations, yeah, or give attach something noting his doubts about its enforceability. So that's option one. Option two is certainly at any point while the matter was before the commission, he could have either filed even an informal letter, given notice, so the parties were at least aware. Because I, the reason I harp on this, and I realize it would be an unusual thing, but if he had given notice while this was before the commission could have taken corrective action. They could have shored this up and put it on clear constitutional footing. And instead, we've ended up in a situation where the district court is just giving him a permanent get out of jail free card. Even in advance of Lucia, first of all, I want to emphasize that even before Lucia was decided, in anticipation of that decision, the full commission did ratify the appointments of the ALJ. So then you get into the separate question of what to do about the individual actions. And as I've mentioned a few times and really do want to underscore, appointments clause concerns aren't jurisdictional. And therefore, the commission, I think, deferred to the parties. I can't get inside the heads of what was going on there. What I can tell you, I'm not aware of them not, but if you're about to tell me they don't, I just don't know.
It says there are five serving commissioners, but the website for ITC says there are four, and it suggests that three of those are serving past their statutory terms. Now, it could well be that the website is just outdated. I don't, I'm asking you, you're their attorney.
Yeah, I apologize. This wasn't something that I focused on in preparing for today's argument. I'd be happy to supply the court with, and I'll talk to my client right after this and let the court know. But yeah, no, I understand, and I apologize. That just wasn't something that I thought was going to be put at issue here. But to return to the fundamental question here, because these are non-jurisdictional, if Apple was happy with this and Qualcomm was happy with this and the litigation is moving forward, there was no affirmative obligation on the part of the commission or the ALJ to take specific corrective action. And there was some onus on a party who wanted to get out from under an action that had been taken by the ALJ prior to the ratification to note it for the commission so that the commission could take that corrective action. And this brings me to the third and final point at which Mr. Sidak could have done something. Number two is, some point, send in a letter. They emphasize, for example, that Professor Calabresi submitted a letter while the matter was before the commission. Certainly, he could have done the same thing. And the third thing is he could have filed basically the suit he ultimately filed, but filed it in April, certainly not later than April of 2019. A suit in which your court, yes. Yeah, essentially asserting, I think the suit in April of 2019 would have effectively said, I am currently under the purported compulsion to return or destroy documents. I don't want to return or destroy those documents. I think this order is unenforceable, and accordingly, I'm seeking a declaratory judgment that that obligation is null and void. So I think that would have been the time. But to give no notice at all of a possible intent not to comply with the voluntary undertaken obligation, to allow the commission, to allow the private parties to rely on the assumption that he's going to do what he said he was going to do, and only then, when he's years later under investigation for a possible breach, to say, actually, this is unenforceable against me, that's where I think we run into problems. We haven't touched at all on ripeness. I'm very happy to talk about this for as long as the court is interested, but I did want to at least briefly touch on ripeness, because it is a tremendous departure from normal orderly judicial review for a court to consider even a constitutional argument, even a threshold argument, while the investigative body here, the commission, is still ascertaining the relevant facts, deciding whether a breach even occurred.
Maybe that is different from the ordinary type of investigation where we look differently at agency's prosecutorial discretion, certain other factors, waiting for them to actually take some
time. Yeah, so I think the commission is still in the process of even ascertaining the relevant facts. For example, Mr. Sydak has raised certain legal arguments to the commission about why he thinks the conduct that he's already admitted to was in fact allowed under the protective order. And I think we would normally allow, under bedrock principles of finality and ripeness, to let the commission go through that process. And I want to analogize this case to the National Treasury Employees Union case we discuss in our brief. It's a canonical ripeness case. And that case involved the constitutionality of the line item veto. Somebody wanted to bring a challenge to that. It's a pure question of law. We're not saying that it required further factual development. It was a constitutional question. And yet, what this court recognized is there's a prudential aspect to ripeness that sometimes it is more appropriate out of separation of powers concerns to let the administrative agency complete its process first, and that sometimes if you don't decide a case prematurely on the front end, you may never need to decide it. And that certainly describes this case. The commission hasn't.
Or the canonical statement. You could have cited that. You could have cited that.
There,
this proposition, for example, right, this involves fitness impression.
Sure. But I.
Here's what. Is your best case Standard Oil, which is about finality under the APA. The case you both sides most discuss is Axel, which is a case about when 1331 is arisen impliedly repealed.
Yeah.
There's a lot of overlap in those doctrines, and you could toss in exhaustion in want to that mix, but you're longer on finality in 1331 cases than you are on prudential rights. And if you compartmentalize a little bit and just think about prudential rightness, the court has said it's a sort of disreputable doctrine, and we don't like prudence doctrines, and we're not going to extend it, and we may reconsider it. And we've said when there's a purely legal question at issue, we don't worry too much about prong two of that. So, you're trying to import the reality of 1331 cases into a prudential rights.
So I don't think I'm the one doing the, I absolutely take your point, Your Honor, and you're right that we do discuss some of those cases interchangeably. But part of the reason we do that is because this court has done the same thing. And in particular, one of the cases we do cite is that Tycor case where one of the, the three-way split. And if you look at footnote 7 of Judge Williams' opinion in that case, it was about 87. It's a little log in tooth. I understand. But if you look at that case, footnote 7 of Judge Williams' opinion, that it cites to a 1984 decision of this case called Public Citizen Health, where the court basically said the finality and the prong one of ripeness, two components converge and can basically be treated interchangeably. I would add that, of course, FTC versus Standard Oil, the first Abbott Longs, the fitness for judicial review. Fitness for
question purely legal, or is it factual and mixed?
I don't agree with, I think National Treasury Employees Union says there's more to fitness than just, is it purely legal? Whether or not, it's not just collateralness, it's, is there an opportunity for this case to go away, essentially? Can this be resolved by the other branches before the judiciary gets involved? The statement, and I'm paraphrasing here, but I think pretty closely, the often unstated, that the prong one incorporates the often unstated but, unstated but true proposition that if we do not decide this case now, we may never need to decide it. And that's true even for pure questions of law, like the constitutionality of the line item veto. And of course, FTC versus Standard Oil, which we discuss at length, had itself discusses Abbott Labs with quite heavily. So I do think these doctrines can't be put, while you're certainly right that they are separate lines of cases, there's a fair amount of overlap there. The other thing I'd point out is I don't understand Mr. Sidak to be taking issue with the fact that if he were arguing to this court, for example, those same legal defenses he's asserted to the commission, that, for example, the protective order scope doesn't reach the transcripts, it only reaches the primary documents, that this suit would be unripe. And the reason for that,
makes and match point. Not, I don't mean that.
Yeah.
Majority,
oh, no.
But I mean, that seems to prove too much. If you take the, you know, if prong one of prudential rightness, it includes will the issue go away, and you mix and match with 1330 mod, you get, you know, Axon would have been
right. Right. And I agree. You can only take it so far.
Even for the defendant who is before the unconstitutionally appointed or insulated adjudicator, that is a more acute problem.
So I think the reason that's not true, and this is crucial in Axon, is Axon said there was a particular here and now injury. It's not, will this case go away? Will the SEC or the FTC ultimately decide to sanction Axon or to sanction Mr. Cochran? But rather, the here and now injury was in, and this is, I'm quoting from page 192 of Axon, and this is the key element of that decision, being held before a, quote, unconstitutionally structured decision maker. And that is the distinguishing feature of Axon. It's the basis on which the court said, this isn't at all inconsistent with Standard Oil. We have no renewed enthusiasm for interlocutory review, but this is a special case. There's an exception when you're being subjected to an unconstitutionally structured decision maker. And I want to emphasize that Mr. Sidak has not challenged the jurisdiction or the constitutional structure of the ITC itself. And in fact, at oral argument in district court, you can see this at JA 142, he expressly said he wasn't challenging jurisdiction.
That is the best of Axon. There's another major strand on improving, which is not challenging some specific action taken in the proceeding.
I think that reading would be far too broad, because if you think of FTC versus Standard Oil, for example, the allegation there was that the proceeding was improperly commenced because the requisite statutory threshold for starting it, whether the commission had reason to believe that there was a violation was not met. Now imagine that Standard Oil's lawyers had just tacked on a due process claim and said that is evidence of an absence of due process, or a First Amendment retaliation claim, and said that is evident because they are proceeding on such patently insufficient evidence in starting this. They're bowing to political pressure. This is clearly retaliation for our public opposition to the administration. I don't think FTC versus Standard Oil comes out any differently post-Axon. So first of all, well, I said that hand in hand with his consent in November of 2017, and you'll forgive me. That's very important to me to emphasize. But what makes this different is the decision maker unconstitutional? There will be lots of cases. For example, if somebody wanted to bring a constitutional challenge to the FTC Act and say there was some defect in it, I think even post-Axon, and that's sort of analogous to the Elgin case, right? In Elgin, somebody was being facing potential repercussions based on the draft, failure to register for the draft. There was a threshold constitutional equal protection challenge to that statute, that it discriminated against men. And there was no question that was the kind of case situation where it was a pure legal question. It was the kind of thing, it was a facial challenge. And yet in Elgin, the Supreme Court still said you have to go through the administrative scheme. Now, again, that's a Thunder Basin case. And I am mindful of your point earlier, Judge Katsas, that I don't want to conflate doctrines too much. But the mere fact that somebody is saying the basis for the proceeding suffers from some inherent constitutional flaw, I think proves far too much. Absolutely. Yeah. So you can get a declaratory judgment as opposed to an injunction. Absolutely. So even before we get to whether they're right. So for the third argument third argument we've made in our brief is the district court committed legal error in failing even to consider the public interest. And in particular, the fact that this is a order that was designed not only to protect the commission, but also to protect the confidential business information of Apple and Intel and third parties who responded to discovery requests over the course of that proceeding. And under this court's recent decision in Zuckerman, for example, even if you think he was entitled to prevail on the merits, and of course we think he's not, but even if you get past that, deciding that he's entitled to prevail on the merits doesn't answer the separate inquiry of whether or not he's entitled to a remedy, an injunctive remedy, and a failure to even consider the public interest is just per se error.
They have the burden. They file what was sent a PI motion that they argue all four.
Right. And
if I have the chronology right, then gets converted into some judgment or summary judgment not responding to that.
Yep.
And we say, to the extent we're even talking about, still talking about this, deny equitable relief because they're unlikely to succeed on the merits and there's no irreparable injury. So you only controvert factors one and two.
So
factors three and four are not subject matter jurisdiction. So if you haven't raised any issue.
Well, I actually do want to push back on that a little bit, but there are a couple points I want to make here. So one point I want to make is I'm very glad you noted the chronology here. There was the parties agreed to convert the PI. And at that point, both parties just briefed this as cross motions for summary judgment. And neither side was really engaging with the equitable factors. The second thing I want to emphasize is that though we certainly didn't brief. Well, it's.
It gets converted into a motion for a permanent injunction.
Well, motion for summary judgment was the focus. But I want to emphasize that the equitable considerations that we're pointing to in this court were absolutely before the district court. Now, I don't want to mislead the court. We did not frame this in terms of the equitable analysis. We were making these points in the context of other arguments. But if you go to JA-123, which is our district court brief, and then JA-183, the oral argument before the district court, we were talking about the same sorts of equitable considerations that our brief in this court talks about. The other thing I want to emphasize is your honor says, well, it's not jurisdictional. And I think that's right, but with a caveat, which is one of baked into the preliminary injunction analysis or the permanent injunction analysis is a recognition that sometimes an injunction is going to impact not just the two parties before the court, but the public at large. And I think that's particularly true when a court is considering basically declaring void and unenforceable an order, the primary purpose of which was to protect non-parties to the proceeding. And when the court enters an injunction without even accounting for that fact, and without even referencing the public interest, I think that is the kind of error this court can and should address. I think this court often, if for an abuse, often in the context of an abuse of discretion standard, the court will sometimes say the lower court committed an error of law in failing to account for something. We send it back so that the court can apply its discretion in the first instance. I don't think that's remarkable. The other thing I want to emphasize here is there are intermediate steps you could take. For example, you could say maybe Mr. Sydak shouldn't be sanctioned, shouldn't be subject to some penalty on the basis of his conduct, but the commission can and should be able to at least ascertain the relevant facts and make sure he at least destroys, to the extent he still has any Apple or Intel or other information, that there's a balance that needs to be struck here to make sure he doesn't continue to retain information that potentially could leak, even if he's not planning on selling it or posting it on the internet now that he has the protection of this injunction. As long as it's on his computer, there's a risk of leak. And you could certainly imagine an equitable analysis here that takes account of Apple and Intel's interests and not, though I do want to emphasize the commission's interests here are substantial as well. People rely on the commission to conduct the kinds of adjudications that require consideration of very sensitive information. Congress recognized that, and we don't want that undermined.
Commission had a better answer, or why has it not just issued a new protection? Again, their only answer seems to be, we think they don't.
There are two answers, Your Honor. So what one is, of course, because there's already a well-established principle that protects commission orders from concluded proceedings, which is the finality. I understand. The second reason is because it's not like that would resolve everything. Mr. Sydak at times says there was an easy fix here. But then if you look at page 36 of his brief, and particularly footnote 2, he actually... So I don't think we could have there if we had just purported to reopen 1,000 long concluded investigations, issue a blanket ratification, and then try to enforce that without getting new signatures from everybody. We may well have the power to do that. If frankly, depending on how this case comes out, maybe we'll have to try. But I think if you read Mr. Sydak's brief, and particularly page 36, I think it would be foolish to assume that that would have just resolved the question, wouldn't have opened up new litigation.
They didn't indicate sanction in, but to the extent all of these equitable considerations go toward whether to issue an injunction or not. It seems like they could solve the IDC's problem.
No, the footnote I'm referring to actually questions whether the whether ratifications are even effective. Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning. May it please the court. We're here today because to this day, 6 years after Lucia, the ITC still hasn't fixed its Lucia problem. The agency has never done anything to address orders entered by ALJs whose appointments were unconstitutional under Lucia. Instead of fixing the problem, the agency is doubling down and instead insisting that this court should allow it to enforce an order that it concedes is unconstitutional. As the district court recognized, that turns the law upside down and makes this an easy case. An agency has no right to enforce an unconstitutional order. That's basically the affirmative part of my case, which is an easy case. The agency tries to avoid that by saying, oh no, you're too early and you're too late. And the agency is wrong on both scores. I'm happy to address the too early arguments or the too late arguments or whatever the court is interested in my addressing.
You are focusing on Lucia, which was the ALJ presiding in the dispute between This is a separate proceeding for a lawfully structured.
Correct, which is Judge Rao.
The injury of being put into a proceeding whose adjudicator is either unlawfully appointed or unlawfully insulated from presidential control. We don't have that.
Right, but as Judge Rao pointed out, the sole basis, or there's an asked, and the my friend conceded, the sole basis for this new proceeding, the proceeding directed against SIDAC, is alleged violations of the protective order entered by that ALJ. There's no other basis. And just to clarify, the injunction in this case does not stop the agency from doing anything beyond the four corners of the protective order. The injunction says defendants are hereby enjoined, and this is a JA 229, from using the protective order from the 337 proceeding investigation as a basis for investigating and or sanctioning plaintiff. So again, the proceeding that we have now is a proceeding aimed solely at enforcing an unconstitutional protective order. It's not...
Merit's theory is that this proceeding before a lawfully structured tribunal has some unconstitutional.
100%, because it is a
different.
Fair enough, Your Honor. In other words, yes, we concede that this is not an adjudication before an improperly appointed adjudicator. It is a proceeding aimed solely at enforcing an order entered by a concededly improperly appointed adjudicator. There's no other, as the questioning with Judge Rao made clear, there's no other, no assertion that there's multiple grounds. The only basis for this proceeding and the only subject of the injunction is the use of the protective order. The agency is correct that is distinguishable from Axon and other cases in that sense, but that's really a distinction without a difference in the sense that it is a, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I'm going to do the mix of match again, which is the general rule is standard order. You're a defendant in an administrative enforcement action don't like what's happening to
sure.
you, you're claiming legal error, you're claiming even constitutional error, you're saying, look, the legal fees are on and up, I can't sleep at night. The general answer is that's part of the ordinary duty of citizenship, and when the case is over, you can make whatever arguments you
want. Correct. Again,
that's the general rule.
That is the general rule, and we do not argue.
That is the exception, at least when you are thrown before an adjudicator unconstitutionally appointed.
That's the question. And said Axon itself said, is this case more like free enterprise clause or more like Elgin? And we submit that this
is your case more like Axon or more like
100% more like Axon, because this is, we're not seeking anything to do with the outcome of the agency proceeding. We're challenging the fact of the agency proceeding. It's the here and now injury of being subjected to the enforcement of an unconstitutional order, which is a structural problem. This case is within.
So if we're just drilling down on individual cases and treating Axon as extendable to prudential rights, it comes down to whether the test is unconstitutional. Illegitimate proceeding or proceeding led by illegitimate proceeding?
Illegitimate proceeding, again, that's the language of Axon, but it's a structural constitutional problem that is completely divorced from the merits. Some of the decisions they're talking about, like they had a constitutional question, which is, well, it's a due process problem if there's no factual basis. And Your Honor, Judge Rao, you were on a panel in the Loma Linda case last year that raised some questions about how would this apply in the context of a Leadham versus Kine Religion Act case. There are some tricky Axon-related issues that are floating around in your radar screen as the D.C. Circuit. But this case, where the claim is the structural constitutional claim, they are here and now. It's this Mr. Sidek, my client, his constitutional section 1331 claim is the exact same claim. It is a claim that my rights under the appointments clause, my structural constitutional rights, which have nothing to do, the merits could be about widgets. We have nothing to do with the way that process turns out. It is, I have a right not to be hauled in to this improper proceeding. Again, improper why? It's improper. It has nothing to do with the merits. In some sense, even their Standard Oil hypo had to do with the merits. If there's no, it's a due process claim. If it's that, Leadham versus Kine, it's a little more meritsy. This claim is exactly the same. I'm sorry. Correct. In other words, I think well, the end of the hypothetical, what my friend just said is, well, in FTC, they could say, well, you know, the statute, the organic statute doesn't give you that power, or there might even be a constitutional problem with the organic statute. I mean, those are much more closely aligned with the merits. I think at this court may find, and the courts generally may have some very interesting work to do on Axon and how far that extends. But this case, which is it's literally an appointments clause challenge. Hundred percent different, and in fact, the injunction doesn't prohibit that. The injunction only says, again, JA 229, they're enjoined from using the protective order. Correct. The here and now injury is not the investigation per se. It's the use of an order entered by an improperly appointed ALJ. Okay, so on that, what they are really making is a Johnson versus Zerbst waiver argument. The agreement, let's look at that agreement. What it literally says, I have it here in front of me, it's JA 48. It says, I agree to be bound by the terms of the protective order. Okay, like we all agree to lots of things. That is not an agreement the judge who entered the order, or the ALJ, was constitutionally appointed. I mean,
the notion that if Mr. Sydak didn't use the appointments clause as a sword to immediately attack the ALJ's appointment when he's an expert witness, all he did is agree to abide by the terms of the predictor. He didn't agree to waive any right. Again, the Johnson versus Zerp standard for waiver of a constitutional right is a knowing waiver. Where in here does it say I agree to waive any objection later? I mean, he's agreeing to abide by that. That assumes that it's valid. He's not agreeing. He's not giving up anything to use it as a shield in a subsequent enforcement proceeding. Well, you could, and that is very much the way the government is trying to push it, but their enforcement proceeding is not a breach of contract proceeding. It's a breach of protective order proceeding. I don't know that they would have the statutory right in an administrative proceeding to do a breach of contract. That goes into Crowell versus Benson and what the administrative authority could do. I mean, maybe there could be a contract. I mean, again, this is just not a breach of contract claim. But we are not arguing here. I want to be very, very clear on this, that the only dispute here is about their attempt to give effect to this protective order. And what's kind of weird here, frankly, is that they're saying it's too early. Their argument is that they should be allowed to proceed with an investigation, with a proceeding, possibly to impose sanctions for a protective order that they've conceded in this proceeding is unconstitutional. They've not defended the merits of this. So this is a particularly weird situation. I think Judge Katsas, you asked a question to my friend about this. Like, what on earth are you all doing trying to proceed with this proceeding to enforce something that you've conceded is unconstitutional? The only answer I can think, well, sorry, Your Honor.
That aspect is very startling.
It started, I think
I
it's-
I wonder if the question of is this more like Standard Oil or is this more like Axon, need a little bit more categorical answer than, like, this is startling because the appointments clause question is so clearly undisputed and the purpose of the enforcement action is so clearly and exclusively to enforce
Yes, so you just,
wow.
Well, to what end? I mean, so I mean, they.
Why shouldn't we think of this as the classic case we're assessing is the defendant is in an enforcement proceeding for a lawfully constituted tribunal and is arguing that the object proceedings.
Because
sounds much less shocking.
I get that, but again, it's somewhat shocking where they have conceded that the thing they want to enforce is invalid. Well, no, but again, I think you, Your Honor, yourself had pointed out that Axon. They brought out one snippet of Axon, which said something about the adjudicator. But I think, as Your Honor yourself pointed out, there's lots of other places in Axon, not even to mention Justice Gorsuch's concurrence, where he is talking about, we have 1331. I mean, a lot of these doctrines, Thunder Basin, they are doctrines of administrative regularity, and that's fine. But again, where you have somebody who has a structural violation, particularly here where it's a conceded structural violation that lies at the root of the only thing the agency is trying to enforce. Again, I think this is probably the best answer to this, which is to say, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Don't the statute require that the enforcement proceeding depends on how obviously unlawful agency.
And fair enough. Look, I that is on right.
Sure.
that's a very difficult standard. Again, I think where it is a structural constitutional argument based on the appointments clause, at least, okay? I mean, this literally is the same structural constitutional claim that Axon said imposed a here and now injury. So the question that they're presenting, that they are positing that there is a dispositive difference between saying that your appointments clause is to the challenge is directed only at the adjudicator of that challenge, or versus something that is at the underlying order that is the sole basis for the entire new proceeding. Whereas here, the only basis for this proceeding is to enforce an order that is concededly entered in violation of the appointments clause. Again, it seems to me that that easily falls within both the spirit and the letter of Axon as saying, what on earth would you allow this to go? There are many different questions. I'm sorry, all right.
Suppose the order were entered in violation of the First
Amendment. Some First Amendment claims may be more bound up in the merits. This is actually very similar to the Loma Linda case where Judge Rao was on the panel, where there was a Leadham versus Kine argument that somebody said, I have a First Amendment right not to be subjected to this. A merits panel said, the majority over Judge Rao's dissent said, that is really just a statutory argument that is intertwined with the facts. Again, the FTC versus Standard Oil argument hypothetical that my friend presented to you, where he said, well, there's zero factual basis for the proceeding, so that's a due process clause. I mean, I think you can draw distinctions where those things are in some way tied up with the merits. This appointments clause issue is a structural constitutional issue that has zero to do with the merits, as we know, because the court in Axon has already said that. Now, again, they were saying that in the context of the adjudicators before it, but it's the same principle that where the claim has nothing to do with anything to do that's going on in this administrative proceeding and nothing that happens in the adjudicative proceeding could in any way, they've never suggested any way in which that could shed any light on this, that whether or not he violated the protective order has any bearing whatsoever in any conceivable way. The only argument they've made is to say, well, we may wind up deciding in his favor. That actually, as Axon and Carr versus Saul makes clear, cuts in our favor, because the here and now, if they apparently what they're trying to do, or what they're saying they have a right to do, is continue to impose all these costs and uncertainty on Mr. Sydak and then say, oh, guess what? We've decided not to impose a sanction. They almost have to do that because they've conceded that the only order on which they're basing the proceeding is unconstitutional. So any sanction that they would impose would have its death warrant on its face if he decided to go to court. What they want to do is really an abuse of the administrative process. I mean, I think this case presents to this court probably the starkest example of what you will see is just a naked abuse. I mean, this wolf is coming as a wolf. These people are not coming here in order to validate some otherwise legitimate process. The only basis, again, I think this goes... Again, if it were some other basis, right?
Use merits question is just in terms of protective order. You say this is retaliatory for something he did.
Then it tends
the
right.
Proceeding is unconstitutional. But because it has
I think that at least that is one of the hard Axon questions. I'd say our case is an easy Axon question. Right. I mean, when you start to get into those kinds of questions, it starts to raise. If they just say this is improperly motivated, I think that probably is a Standard Oil versus Exxon thing. I don't deny that that is the background rule. I think, though, if you take the same approach that the Supreme Court did in Axon, and I understand Axon is a Thunder Basin case, but it's the very same kinds of issues. Again, I think those kind of things where you have to even think of the merits
Before there was ever even the proceeding after the Qualcomm, there was presumably some regulation that said you can't violate an ITC.
Sure, that's it. There's a statute that, and there's regulations. Yeah.
Then comes Qualcomm proceeding, unconstitutionally appointed ALJ issues technical order, violates, arguably, possibly, allegedly violates the unconstitutional structure of ALJ's technical order. Then this proceeding, if you think of it like that, proceeding is for his violation. This proceeding is by a perfectly legitimate constitutionally appointed decision maker.
Now, yes.
And it's for his violation of a statute and regulation that are completely fine. And the protective order is really just a piece of evidence showing that he violated a perfectly fine regulation.
Your Honor, if that were the case, that this would be a different proceeding. Again, I think, and I think that was Judge Rao's first question to my friend, is this a case about a violation of the protective order or some other statutory or regulatory?
Is it violating the protective order, or is it for violating the basically a quasi-contract he agreed to abide by federal?
Oh.
My scenario is kind of, I guess, the third. Is this proceeding for the violation of a regulation that says there's what you're doing?
Yes.
Okay, well then I'm sorry I misunderstood the question.
No, but
which you
clearly, it is. If you look at the May 25th letter, I think it is clearly the protective. Just look at the first line. Dear Mr. Sidek, this letter concerns a possible breach of an, the administrative order, APO, issued in blah, blah, blah. That's JA 49. And again, Your Honor, we know if it were something broader, as Your Honor's question is asking, that wouldn't be enjoined. The only thing that is enjoined by the injunction, it's a very narrow injunction that the district court entered in this case.
Weren't the original regulations can't violate the then would this proceeding happen?
If you could separate that from the protective order, I mean, I guess that raises some very tricky issues. I think that order seems to me to be entirely contingent on the validity of the protective order. So I don't think that regulation alone, thou shalt not violate a protective order, is really a statutory or regulatory basis independent of a particular. If I'm understanding your hypothetical correctly, I think that would be covered by the injunction. So I don't think they can just be cute and say like, oh, we're no longer the protective order, we're now the rule. But as long as it is about the protective order, again, entered by an unconstitutionally appointed ALJ. And you're, again, you asked my opponents this question, my friends this question. Why don't you guys fix this? We wouldn't be here if they had fixed this. And that goes back to the equities of this. That's what's so weird, that we're here in the DC circuit today using all of our time when this agency could just have fixed it as other agencies did. Well, he has made clear in his affidavit, which again, that's a whole other part of this case that isn't here, about the coercion of that affidavit, that he destroyed the parts of the case file that were beyond the confidential, about the hearing transcript. Again, let's go back to the genesis of this case. This is about his use of pin sites to a confidential hearing transcript where he was filing FOIA requests. They turn and says, aha, gotcha. This means you're violating the protective order, right? They have never alleged that he violated, that he actually disclosed anything. Correct. And again, you're going to the equities of, well, anybody may remember that there's no obligation to erase your memory. Your Honor, that's why I think they should try to fix this immediately, if not yesterday. As we are here together today right now, there is no legally valid thing stopping people. Our only point is to say, when they bring up this parade of horribles, they bring up Apple, they bring up all these other companies, right? They can fix that. You don't need, under the statute and regulatory authority they have, they could fix it today by entering some kind of an order saying anybody who received confidential information under a protective order entered by an unconstitutionally appointed judge is prohibited from doing that. Until they fix that, though, they can't go around and say, like, oh, no, we have to have the obligation to enforce an unconstitutional order. With respect to SIDAC, it's too late. Yeah, they can't. Well, no, I'm sorry. I thought I was going back to Judge Walker's hypothetical. He was asking about things that Mr. SIDAC might do in the future. If today they entered an order, they could certainly stop Mr. SIDAC. We don't say Mr. SIDAC gets forever and for all time carte blanche to do whatever he wants. At least until there's a protective order, Mr. SIDAC and anybody else whose conduct is governed by a pre-2018 protective order. Why do I think they have an issue? Well, they have. Oh. Your Honor, that's a long answer about this agency. This is an agency that even after Lucia, if you look at the Federal Register notice in September of 2018, which is in the record, they continued to insist after Lucia that they never had a Lucia problem because the other commissioners had a veto on the chairman's unilateral thing. Even though 10 years ago in free enterprise, this court said multi-member enterprises, the head of the agencies, the head of the department is the whole agency. So this is an agency where accountability is an extremely foreign concept. I mean, this dispute should never have arrived in federal court. It is a shocking manifestation of where we are in administrative law in the year 2024, that we are here debating this and that we haven't, the federal government is coming here and saying, yes, please give us carte blanche. Please overturn this injunction that stops the agency from using a protective order that the agency has conceded is unconstitutional. So again, this blows my mind that they have not tried to fix it. I think they think they can get away with it. And so why not? And, I certainly hope this court agrees with the arguments in our brief and with the district court's opinion, which very carefully, and again, underscores the narrowness. The district court said, look, if this were a parties, different story. Parties have their rights and obligations at issue. They have certain obligations. We have never in this country had a world where anybody who has any kind of obligation entered into confidentiality, decorum in court. If somebody in the court starts disrupting this court, right, we all have certain obligations. That doesn't mean that just you have a certain implicit or explicit obligation that you're waiving your right thereafter as a non-party. If there ever is an enforcement proceeding against you to bring whatever defenses you might want to bring. Again, that has never been the law in this case. And so I think in this country, and I think their attempts to enforce this order take administrative law well beyond where it has ever been.
Where it's being right, there is also, and actually, so why shouldn't we at least send this back for the district court to make factors 3 and 4? We might have that.
Two reasons, Your Honor. This remedy provision, and I invite you to look at the briefs below on this, and I urge you to do that. I know you have, because that came up, right? They have an obligation, right? Right. They never challenged 3 and 4, right? Everybody agreed. Well, again, he didn't need. But that affirmative misstatement, Your Honor, if that didn't exist, that's not critical to his reasoning. I think his point is the only remedy that is, when you have a more traditional way that one of these appointments clause challenges comes up, like in Lucia, it's reassignment for adjudication before a properly appointed decision maker. When the agency, again,
It's almost crazy to imagine this is what is happening, but this is the nightmare that Mr. Sajdic is living in. They have decided to actually try to enforce a concededly unconstitutional order, right? And so the only remedy to stop that is to say, stop that, right? You can't go and reassign anything to somebody else, right? They never disputed that point. That was kind of the clear thing. And with respect to they never said there was some other adequate remedy at law. They never suggested that. With respect to the public interest factors, the district court, if you look at JA 227, he does say, if any brought, so in other words, let's just go to the procedural point. This is bedrock law that you, as the D.C. Circuit, are not a self-directed board of inquiry looking for possible mistakes. That whenever a lawsuit has a certain proceeding in the adversary system, and the government is a very worthy adversary, if they thought that the court could not enter an injunction because of the public interest considerations, it was up to them to tell the district court, you cannot enter this because of these public interest considerations. They said boo about that. Now, to come up on appeal to the D.C. Circuit and say, please vacate that because we've now come up with these other arguments. In any event, so that's the procedural argument, that there has never been in the history of American law, as far as I'm aware, some argument that the injunctive factors are impervious to the normal rules of waiver and forfeiture. But even on the merits, the district court actually does say on JA 227, if any broader reliance issues, interests are affected in this case, the commission is to blame. Unlike other agencies, the commission took insufficient curative action. That is a complete answer to their argument about the alleged equities here, the apples of the world who are going to be suffering, right? That they can fix it. The answer is not, yes, go ahead and continue. We're going to withhold an injunction. You know, go ahead and continue to enforce the concededly unconstitutional order. If you look at, we made this point in our brief, it's very interesting. They don't ever say this is impossible to fix. There's one sentence on page 30 of their reply brief where they say, well, it's complicated. Okay, well, many things are complicated in life, but that doesn't mean that means that they can basically be allowed to enforce an allegedly or a concededly unconstitutional. There's no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. You've already been very generous with your time, so I just want to make a few quick points. First, I want to emphasize that I heard Mr. Landau repeatedly refer to a structural constitutional error in dealing with the Axon-type issue here. I just want to be clear that the district court here expressly said the opposite at JA 213. This is not the kind of structural challenge that involves being hailed in front of an unconstitutionally structured decision maker, which inflicts a here and now injury regardless of the outcome. His alleged injury here is much more limited. It is tied to the potential outcome of the proceeding, not the mere fact of having to appear before the ITC, who he concedes at JA 142 has jurisdiction. Second, he asks, why are we even doing this? Why is the ITC, this Javert-like entity, going out there? And I think there's two answers to that I want to emphasize. The first is that it's important to the commission at least to ascertain the facts here, which it has not been allowed to do. He says all they had were some pin sites in a FOIA request. That's where it started. And then when we asked, it turned out until recently, he'd kept his entire case file. That's what came out in the affidavits. So the fact that when there was an initial thread that the commission started pulling on, I think is certainly relevant. If he's been disclosing information, we don't know that yet. He says he hasn't, but the commission hasn't had a chance to drill in. Obviously, that would implicate a far broader range of concerns. The other aspect I want to emphasize here is I heard him repeatedly say we concede it's invalid. And I think that the protective order is invalid. And I think that that's not a great encapsulation of our position. What we haven't contested is that the ALJ wasn't properly appointed when it was issued. But under traditional principles of finality, the commission does not believe that it is enforcing an unconstitutional or unenforceable order. Before Lucia came down, literally millions of decisions were issued by ALJs in dozens of agencies. And for the most part, there were some Lucia claims preserved, and the government had to redo a lot of cases on the basis of Lucia. But that number is dwarfed by the number that everybody has just assumed continue to have vitality. And yes, the government routinely continues to proceed on the basis of the validity of ALJ decisions that were issued pre 2010. The last thing I just wanted to do was Judge Walker. That's the timeliness argument, not the consent argument. And which goes into the collateral attack and the rider point. And the last thing I just want to do, Judge Walker, you were asking about the regulatory scheme that underlies the protective order and what's being enforced here. I would refer the court to 19 CFR 210.25, which provides exactly as Your Honor suggested, the relevant set of regulations.
Get that you're not just proceeding because he failed to do something he agreed to do. Some, you know, he just like absent protective order. He told the ICC, you know, I'll run after the game, basically.
Yeah.
And he didn't give me respect. That's not your, but is your theory, not theory, but is the way this proceeding works as follows. Years ago, there was a statute authorizing a regulation. Regulation is not challenged. The regulation says you cannot violate a privacy protective order. And you are bringing essentially an enforcement proceeding against him for violating valid regulation that says you cannot violate it.
So I think they go hand in hand. Part of the problem, this proceeded on the basis of letters to this point. So it was started with a letter. It's captioned, you know, possible breach of the protective order. But the reason the commission, the regulatory authority underlying that, so to that extent, when I answered Judge Rao, what I was certainly saying that we are proceeding on the basis of the protective order, not a contract theory, not just a bare violation of statute independent of the protective order. But the protective order very much goes hand in hand with, and the reason we have authority to enforce it is because of this underlying regulation. So, well, we can't do that. I want to be clear. So honestly, and the court should be aware of this. These are laid out in 210.134.C. Mostly it's like letters of reprimand. Could be a private reprimand, could be a public reprimand. If it was more, the more they escalate, the most extreme things we can do are bar you from practicing before the commission and a potential referral to like your state bar authority. Yes, absolutely.
Not with individual protective order.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, for vigorous and excellent arguments. The case is submitted.